It was nice to watch that video of Mike Cockerell. I think it's really important that we remember him alongside Les Murray. When JD asked me to speak at this conference and to curate this conference, I was very adamant that it become a forum of ideas, not just of nostalgia. And I think that's why, you know, that's why I wanted to put up Mike's name for the oration lecture, because Mike wasn't just a guy for nostalgia. He was an ideas man. And, you know, Mike's words, they reverberated with history, but he always wrote for the present moment. And I believe this conference should do the same thing. Australian soccer has long been guilty of forgetting. For the past decade and a half, as the game experienced stunning advances both on and off the field, we've wanted to look forward, not back. This created an emptiness within the game. Many long-term supporters found it insulting, and many of our Socceroos, and our former Socceroos, found it disrespectful. Having said that, there has been some effort by FFA and the A-League clubs to re-engage with history. The FFA Cup has been a fantastic vehicle to reintegrate the clubs of the past into meaningful national competition. And the statistics of the National Soccer League, thanks to Andrew Howe at the back there, are now being recognised alongside that of the A-League. Yet as we look back, it is important to remember that we should avoid sentimentality. There is a danger in mythologising the past, which in turn blinds us to some of the structural problems and the uncomfortable realities of soccer in this country. The truth is, Australian soccer is so diverse that history will evoke many memories and feelings within different communities. In Rockhampton, for example, they still revere the Wesley Hall Cup, a 1-metre-tall trophy made of pure Mount Morgan silver, which was first awarded in 1895. How many of us here today would even know that this cup still exists out in the boondocks of central Queensland? The Wesley Hall is one of hundreds of competitions, and it's the oldest of those competitions which still exist in this country. Today, I've been asked to speak specifically about the struggle to establish soccer on a national basis in Australia. Much of the research and findings comes from my book, The Death and Life of Australian Soccer, which was published in August last year. For the next half an hour or so, I want to discuss the rise and fall of the NSL, the transition to the A-League, and the progress of the W-League. I'll examine issues such as identity, ownership, geography, and finance. Underpinning each of these issues is the game's long search for stability, perhaps the most elusive goal in the four decades of National League football. Before I get to the detail, I think we should reflect for a moment on the past 18 months. At the grassroots, soccer continues to be the most popular team sport for men and boys, and second only to netball for women and girls. Melbourne City won the W League for a third year in a row, in a season marked by increased professionalism for the women. In the A-League, Melbourne Victory won a fourth title. On the international stage, the Socceroos and the Matildas both qualified for their respective World Cups, and the Matildas in particular are coming off a breakthrough year in 2017. Across the board, however, attendances and television ratings for soccer have dropped alarmingly. Off the field, Les Murray and Michael Cockerell, as we've mentioned, and you know, these were two of the finest journalists ever to grace Australian soccer, they both passed away, and I think that's left a hole that is yet to be filled. There has been a breakdown of trust and communication between the FFA, the member federations, the clubs, the PFA, and under FIFA's watch, these relevant parties are currently sorting through long-standing governance issues. In March 2017, the Australian Association of Football Clubs was formed, which claims to represent more than 150 NPL clubs from across the country. Against this backdrop, the FFA are working on a new operating model for the A-League, have released its criteria for expansion, and will soon determine two new clubs to enter the competition in 2019. All in all, it has been a frenetic period for Australian soccer. The problems faced by our national competitions, and in particular the A-League, have been the cause for much anxiety about the future. In his recent book, the former Socceroos boss Ange Postecoglou set out some of the inadequacies of the A-League. There are not enough teams, not enough opportunities for young players, not enough games in the season, and importantly, no clear vision for what the league might look like in the coming decades. We should be right in the middle of an investment boom, wrote Postecoglou. The historic challenge that we face, as I've written before, is to break the bottleneck on development without compromising the commercial viability of the professional game. At present, there are two schools of thought that exist about the future of our national competition. Roughly, I have categorised them as the expansionists and the traditionalists. The expansionists, led by FFA, want to introduce more franchises into the competition over the next few seasons. I think most would agree that between 14 to 18 teams would be an ideal number. The traditionalists, meanwhile, led by AAFC, are calling for the creation of a second division with a system of promotion and relegation. In other words, the expansionists seek to increase the size of the A-League cartel, while the traditionalists seek to break up that cartel. And here lies the great incoherence of Australian soccer at the present moment. On the one hand, we have Deloitte, a multinational services company, assessing the proposed locations, the financial capacity, the vision and the strategy for the expansion bids. The current A-League franchises all have license agreements which are locked in, and Fox Sports has virtually demanded that the next teams come from Sydney, Melbourne or Brisbane. Yet on the other hand, we have people such as Tom Kallas, one of the founders of AAFC, arguing that Australian soccer does not operate in a unique market and that our national competition should migrate to a pyramid system with promotion and relegation between the various tiers. Other prominent football personalities such as Mark Bosnich, Simon Hill and Michael Lynch have mounted similar arguments in recent years. Ultimately, one of those approaches must win the day. Either we continue with the close-up approach of expansion, or we embrace the chaos of a second division with promotion and relegation. Now, it's not my job as a historian to dampen the dreams of soccer salesmen, new age evangelists, or would-be administrators. My job is simply to provide some context about how and why we reach this fork in the road, and to perhaps remind us of some of the lessons that we might learn. I want to begin by taking us back to the 1950s, a period of profound change in the style, the atmosphere, and the structure of Australian soccer. Between 1945 and 1965, as Europe recovered from the horror of World War II, more than 2 million immigrants arrived in Australia. They came from the United Kingdom, often nicknamed the 10-pound Poms, and from countries such as Germany, the Netherlands, Hungary, Malta, Greece, Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Although the government wanted these people to assimilate into the Australian way of life, the experience of large-scale migration gradually changed the way we ate, the way we dressed, the way we socialised, and the way we spoke. Perhaps more than any other activity, immigration radically changed the way we played soccer. From the late 1800s to the early 1950s, Australian soccer was not unlike the other codes of football. Most clubs were organised around their local district and run mainly by Anglo-Australian men. Here in Melbourne, for instance, the clubs had district names such as Sunshine United, Sandringham City, Brighton, Moreland and Footscray City. By the late 1960s, however, following a revolution in the game's administration, the clubs had names such as South Melbourne Hellas, Wilhelmina, Juventus, Melbourne Hungaria and Croatia. This particular image was taken at a match between Wilhelmina and South Melbourne Hellas in 1962. Take note of the large crowd and the different national flags that are fluttering above the grandstand. For me, this image best represents the romance and the passion of the soccer boom of the 1960s. Now, of course, migrants and their children played a range of different sports, not just soccer. What made soccer different was the immense number of migrants who were involved not only as players, but also as coaches, journalists, club representatives, and federation officials. Migrants literally ran the game. Primarily, these migrant soccer clubs had been created to provide a community outlet and a social lubricant. Lex Marinos, the famous Greek-Australian actor, once described the old football clubs as places where people could relax, sing their songs, dance their dances, and be treated with respect and dignity. They were, he wrote, a refuge from the other world. Yet for many other Australians, who feared the creation of ethnic ghettos, this was quite threatening. The language that was used in opposition to migrant soccer clubs often reflected the pervading government ideology of assimilation. In 1950, for example, the Sporting Globe newspaper reported that migrants should be assimilated into the ranks of teams mainly of British stock. 1 year later, a committeeman from the Essendon Football Club said that people who come to this country and accept all the advantages should support Australian rules rather than furthering their own code. The message here was clear. Assimilation meant speaking English, anglicising the family name, and dropping soccer for Australian rules, cricket, and rugby league. Yet as these migrants grew in confidence, soccer actually became a site of resistance to assimilation. Migrants rebuilt the game in their own image and began to dictate its culture and its conversations. New ideas, such as night games held under floodlights, were seen as revolutionary. With almost missionary zeal, these migrant clubs established higher standards, both on and off the field. In the 1960s, football in Australia was very much a state-based affair. In rugby league, there were separate competitions in Sydney and in Brisbane, as well as in the country areas of New South Wales and Queensland. In Australian rules, too, the states ran their own competitions, with political and financial power centred here in Melbourne. But in soccer, there was a desire among those migrants to establish their game on a national basis. As one soccer newspaper reported in 1962, the stage is set for a complete breakaway from the old, parochial way of life. That year, 1962, the Australian Soccer Federation established the Australia Cup, a national knockout tournament that was similar in some ways to the FA Cup in England. Although it only lasted for 7 years, clubs came from every single state to compete. This particular photo is from Slavia Port Melbourne, and they're celebrating with the old trophy in 1963. They defeated Footscray JUST, Apia Leichhardt, Adelaide Juventus, and Polonia Melbourne in their cup run. Now, the Australia Cup was significant because it marked soccer's first step towards a national competition. The next step, of course, was the formation of the National Soccer League, which in 1977 became Australia's first national football competition of any code. The founding clubs of the NSL came from New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, and the ACT. Eventually, the competition would also spread to Western Australia and to New Zealand. I think there's a few crucial points to make about the timing of the National Soccer League. First, the soccer boom of the 1960s, which had been fueled mostly by single migrant men, was actually over by the late 1970s. Crowds had actually begun to decrease as those migrants found wives, raised children, and began to slowly integrate into Australian society. The common view, I think, is that the NSL was born out of the Socceroos' qualification to the 1974 World Cup. In fact, the NSL was formed in response to a huge crisis of confidence within the game. Second, the National Soccer League was established at a time when multiculturalism became public policy. In those early years of the NSL, the Fraser government founded the Ethnic Affairs Council, Multicultural Resources, and also SBS. The government was now telling migrants to celebrate their culture, speak their languages, and pass on those traditions to their children. Now, this should have been of great consequence to the National Soccer League, which was in many ways a pioneering institution of Australian multiculturalism. Most clubs in those days, of course, had some sort of ethnic affiliation, be it Greek, Italian, Croatian, Jewish, or Macedonian. Yet even in the age of multiculturalism, the general perception of the traditional ethnic clubs did not change. And in this context, a soccer competition that was effectively run by ethnic communities was always going to struggle in the battle for hearts and minds. As the soccer reporter Andrew Detre wrote in 1978, migrants are perfectly entitled to form whatever association or union they want, be that a church choir, a welfare agency, a scout group, or a soccer team. The trouble lies elsewhere. Australians born here are entitled to ignore these. And they do. So the great challenge for the NSL, particularly in the 1980s, was to create a national competition that appealed to Australians of all backgrounds. Throughout the 80s, in an attempt to broaden soccer's appeal, people argued over names and logos, over expansion, over switching the season from winter to summer, and over whether the competition should have a final series, and about the role of promotion and relegation. Broadly speaking, the argument was between those who wanted to maintain European traditions and those who believed that the NSL needed to adopt the Australian way. First, the debate over names and logos. Many traditional supporters believe that in a multicultural society, they had the right to retain names such as Adelaide Juventus, Sydney Croatia, or South Melbourne Hellas. Yet these clubs had taken on the wider remit of promoting soccer in the general public, and many outsiders felt that those names promoted ethnic separatism, not multiculturalism. The Hakoa Club from Sydney provides one interesting example. The club changed its name from Hakoa Eastern Suburbs to Eastern Suburbs Hakoa, to Sydney City, and finally to the Sydney City Slickers. Yet still nobody turned up to their games. The same was actually generally true of all the other clubs. I think it's important to remember that in nearly three decades, despite having a virtual monopoly over top flight soccer, not one of the traditional clubs managed to attract a broad base of supporters. There were, however, two clubs that briefly managed to break through this identity crisis. In the first 5 years of the NSL, Canberra City and Newcastle KB United were pioneers of the broad-based club model. Both Canberra and Newcastle received widespread support from local businesses, local politicians, local media, as well as their local soccer communities. They took deliberate measures to avoid any ethnic or political affiliations. In Canberra City's first application to join the NSL, the president, David Dillon, wrote, the Australian public will support soccer if they see quality football marketed professionally. The public will be quick to see that the proposed members of the National League merely represents ethnic groups, and the Australian public as a whole will not identify with an ethnic group. Likewise, in 1978, the president of Newcastle KB United said, "We can only improve on an area basis, one major area against another. Perhaps Sydney would do better with two teams, and so would Melbourne." That was 1978. The fundamental appeal of Newcastle KB United and Canberra City was that they took apart the tribalism of ethnic club soccer and created a new type of club that was more attractive generally to people of all backgrounds. Naturally, this led many people to ask why this process couldn't be replicated in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Adelaide, and also used to expand the competition to places such as Wollongong, Perth and Townsville. There were other examples from overseas too. In the late 1970s, the North American Soccer League was progressing on a city-by-city basis. In 1979, the journalist Andrew Detre travelled to the United States to investigate. When he returned to Australia in 1980, he wrote a series of articles called Made in the USA. He recommended that the NSL shift to the broad-based club model, that clubs attract independent capital from large corporations, that players become full-time professionals, that television packages be sold on a national basis, and that the season be switched from winter to summer. He also recommended that the five clubs in Sydney pool their resources together to create two super clubs. Sydney can and will support two teams, he wrote, but only if those two teams belong to much larger and more broader groups and through their neutral name, organisation and composition also appeal to the average uninvolved Australians. In each of these suggestions, what Detre was really advocating for was that Australian soccer break from tradition. Yet many people dismissed his ideas out of hand. On the issue of summer soccer, for example, many of his fellow journalists thought he'd gone completely mad. But the passage of time would eventually prove Detre correct. Although summer soccer went against tradition, it brought the Australian season in line with Europe, it allowed players to play football all year round, and it led to bigger crowds and increased media coverage. Another point of debate for the followers of the NSL was whether the champion should be the team that won the grand final or the team that finished on top of the ladder. The first five seasons of the NSL were concluded with an uneasy compromise. The top clubs did play a final series, but the winner of the grand final was not actually considered the overall champion. Instead, that accolade belonged to the team with the most competition points. In other words, when Hakoa Sydney City won the grand final in 1978 and 1979 and finished top of the table in 1977, 80 and 81, only the latter three counted as National League titles. Of course, this created plenty of confusion, even among the diehard soccer fans. In 1986, Adelaide City were considered the champions after beating Sydney Olympic in a memorable grand final. Yet the very next season, the final series was completely scrapped, and the NSL reverted to the traditional first-past-the-post system. So I think it's worth pausing here for a moment on season 1978. By this time, the NSL had been running for a decade, and the other football codes had begun their own transition to a national competition. In Australian rules, the Victorian League had spread to Sydney, Perth, and Brisbane, and there were plans to bring in a side from Adelaide. But while Australian rules was expanding, the NSL was contracting. Even before the season began, the most successful club, Hakoa Sydney City, pulled out from the competition. Their demise left 13 clubs, each backed by a different ethnic community, whether it be Greek, Italian, Croatian, Macedonian, Hungarian, Maltese, or Yugoslav. Of those clubs, 5 were from Sydney, 7 were from Melbourne, and just 1 was from Adelaide. The teams from Canberra, Newcastle and Brisbane had all been either folded or been relegated from the competition. 2 reviews were commissioned by the Australian Soccer Federation to try and make sense of all this mess. Both recommended that promotion and relegation be abolished. In 1981, the Booth Report noted that promotion and relegation is simply not a practical system for a sport that wishes to develop nationally. In 1990, the Bradley Report blamed promotion and relegation for turning the NSL into a Sydney-Melbourne competition. The Bradley Report also noted that promotion and relegation had the effect of, and I quote, teams concentrating their time and resources on the field and neglecting such areas as the development of facilities and their spectator base. Unsurprisingly, the attendances for season 1987 were terrible. Marconi versus South Melbourne, for example, attracted just 1,800 people in Sydney, and the crowd for the return fixture was even lower. As there was no final series that season, RPL Leichhardt were crowned champions after finishing 6 points clear at the top of the table. Their final game against Sydney Croatia drew less than 4,000 people. By the end of the year, Johnny Warren, who of course was one of the staunchest defenders of these traditional clubs, could see that a change was needed. It is time, he said, to turn our backs on ethnic soccer as a staple for the code in this country. So in many ways, the 1987 season serves as a timely reminder of why our national competition cannot succeed in its traditional form. Instead, it needed to be rebuilt to adapt to the realities of the Australian market. Now, to have a little bit of a break from all these problems, I think it should be remembered that the NSL also produced some terrific personalities. I want to briefly recount the story of Mark Viduka, who I believe is the greatest player this country has ever produced. Viduka was born in Melbourne in 1975, the son of Croatian migrants Joe and Rose. As a child, he played junior football for Melbourne Croatia and supported the senior team in the NSL. We watched Melbourne Croatia play and we hoped to God, he later remembered. In the early 1990s, the Australian Soccer Federation ordered Melbourne Croatia to change its name to Melbourne Knights. In 1993, Viduka made his NSL debut and scored his first goal in just his second match. For 2 consecutive seasons in 94 and 95, Viduka won a clean sweep of NSL awards, including top goal scorer, under 21 player of the year, and also player of the year. And in 1995, at just 19 years of age, Viduka helped Melbourne Knights to its first NSL title. The president of Croatia, Franjo Tudjman, visited Australia and convinced Viduka to sign for Dinamo Zagreb in the Croatian First Division. This was Viduka's first move in what became a long career abroad, but I think it's important to remember how it all began. First, Viduka had a passion for the game and was raised in a culture that supported his ambition. Second, he had the immense benefit of spending time under Ron Smith at the Australian Institute of Sport. And third, he was immediately given an opportunity by his club in the NSL. I think Remo Nogarotto summed it up very well when he said, "The ethnic soccer club gave you a vehicle that you were completely comfortable with, in a sport that you loved, within a community that was your own, and within a very formalised structure that was the national competition." The big question for the 1990s, however, was whether these traditional clubs were going to survive at all into the 21st century. By 1995, the NSL had dropped promotion and relegation, switched the season to summer, reintroduced the final series, and so the game was steadily moving away from its traditional base. And then came Perth Glory in 1996 and Adelaide United in 2003. Both of these clubs prioritised local talent and represented entire cities rather than small districts or ethnic communities. They regularly attracted crowds of more than 10,000 people and received glowing press coverage in both local and national media. Let me be very clear on this point. Perth Glory and Adelaide United completely broke away from traditional ideas about how a club should be run. They were private entities, which meant that the owners were not answerable to supporters, they were not answerable to a social club, or to one particular ethnic group. Perth Glory in particular tried to shake things up. They took a non-traditional name. They spent big on advertising and promotions. They paid their players as full-time professionals, and they wore these outrageous purple and orange jerseys. This was an enormous shift in the culture and the administration of Australian soccer. The owner of Perth Glory, Nick Tanner, could see that this was the only way forward, not just for Perth, but for the competition as a whole. "My biggest concern," he said in 1996, "is that if the other clubs don't adopt the same attitude, if they don't move with the times, then the public here will quickly become disillusioned. The truth is that Perth can only succeed if the league succeeds." The players, too, saw that the clubs and the competition needed to be totally rebuilt. More than any other stakeholder, the players had suffered from the chaos and the instability of the NSL's first two decades. Full-time professionalism came late, and even then, wages and conditions were meagre at best. The PFA, which had been formed in 1993, spent a decade trying to lift the standard of Australian soccer. What made the PFA different to other unions, as Brendan Schwab recently pointed out, was that it was not simply fighting for a slice of a massive economic pie. The PFA, Brendan said, had to build the pie from scratch. In 2002, the Players' Union released a report for a new national competition. It remains to this day the most thorough piece of research ever to be conducted into how a national league might actually look in this country. The players wanted 10 clubs in total, 3 from Sydney, 2 from Melbourne, 1 each from Adelaide, Brisbane and Perth, and 2 more from regional centres. Importantly, the PFA wanted these to be community franchises with strong ties to local businesses, local supporters, and local soccer clubs. Each club was to be based on what the PFA called the five-pillar strategy: quality, atmosphere, community, local brands, and visibility. The NSL Task Force, which began in 2003, borrowed much from the PFA's research. Yet under the new administration of the FFA, which was obviously led by Frank Lowy and John O'Neill, the A-League was established with just 8 franchises. This was Australian soccer's final transition from a traditional game to a mainstream commercial business. On the cover of the first business plan for the A-League, the mission statement was to build a new mass entertainment product in the form of a national competition. I just want to repeat that again. A new mass entertainment product in the form of a national competition, not the other way around. Now, the transition from the NSL to the A-League meant many things. First, it was a process of consolidation. While the NSL featured anywhere between 12 and 24 clubs, the 8 A-League franchises meant less opportunities for young Australians to play professional football. However, it also led to better wages and conditions for those who did make it into the system. Second, it was a process of privatisation. Unlike the traditional clubs of the NSL, the A-League franchises are all privately owned, and many of them obviously by private foreign companies and business people. Third, it was a process of gentrification and assimilation. Rather than playing at community-owned grounds in the suburbs, A-League matches were played at large stadiums in the centre of each city. The food, the culture, and the atmosphere at games became much more commercially oriented. In other words, every form of diversity was tightly controlled. The idea was pretty simple. These new broad-based franchises would allow fans to gradually create a new collective identity. On the Central Coast, a place that was never associated with soccer before the A-League, the Mariners created a genuine football community within 5 years. In Brisbane, within 3 seasons, the average crowd at Raw games was up to around 15,000 people. In Melbourne and Sydney, Victory and FC are now well-established entities with sustainable ownership, strong commercial partners, and an army of supporters. And the latest franchise, the Western Sydney Wanderers, has been very successful both on and off the field. Even though the Wanderers likes to call itself a community club, there is no doubt that it is also a privately owned franchise. Yet that has not stopped fans from going to games, buying the jersey, or even creating a unique culture. In actual fact, on the whole, Australian soccer fans have rejected traditional clubs in favour of new ideas and new ownership structures. There have, of course, been some problems with all the A-League clubs, but I think it's important to remember that these are the failures of mismanagement, not necessarily of design. And for all of those problems, we now have more than 10 serious bids to enter the A-League. Many of them have backing from all levels of politics, from big business, and from local soccer clubs and associations. So clearly something is going right. As it stands, there is an enormous gulf between the A-League and the clubs of the National Premier Leagues. The AAFC claims that their average annual turnover of the NPL clubs is around $500,000. By contrast, the annual turnover for the A-League clubs is more than $10 million. There is a push, of course, for a national second division to help bridge that gap. In effect, what we now have is people developing models for two national competitions. Moving forward, I think there are five key lessons that emerge from the 41 seasons of National League football in Australia. One, they need to be representative of the clubs, whether it be of an entire regional town, a medium-sized city, or a large district within a major city. Two, they need to be driven by local talent. For me, this is one of the lessons that we've forgotten from the early successes of Perth Glory and Adelaide United. Football clubs are at their best and most representative when local people are given an opportunity to succeed. Three, they need to be privately owned or at the very least guaranteed by a wealthy consortium of business people. This has historically led to better wages and conditions for the players, more effective marketing and promotions, and improved results on the field. Four, they need to be strategically placed around the country. In the next 20 years, it is entirely possible that the A-League could be the only national competitions that includes one or more clubs in each state, as well as the ACT. And five, they need to be protected. Australia is a unique market. Where else in the world is there four codes of football competing for supporters, for sponsorship dollars, and for a space in the public imagination? In this country, there is no precedent for a commercially viable national competition existing with promotion and relegation. Now, I'm aware that that will sound like heresy to some of the traditionalists in the audience. I think we must now accept that Australian sport is a business. Just like the AFL, the NRL, and cricket's Big Bash, it is pegged to television deals and to major commercial sponsorships. For the A-League to survive, it must eventually be run as an independent entity from the FFA, and it must expand to at least 16 teams within the next decade. The W-League must be part of that process. One of the great advances of Australian soccer in the past decade has been the creation of the W-League, which in turn has directly improved the standard of our Matildas. From 1974 to the early 2000s, the Australian Women's Soccer Association had operated as a separate entity from the Men's Federation. The women organised their own funding, their own sponsorships, their own national championships, and their own national team. I think most would agree that the shift to one organisation has been beneficial to the sport as a whole. One of the reasons Melbourne City have been so successful in the W-League is because they have truly adopted the spirit of the one club idea. They have treated their female players as a valuable asset, not as a burden. Before City entered the W-League, many clubs were run by member federations. Now, all the W-League sides, except of course for Canberra United, are run by their A-League sides. Yet as the A-League expands, I think it's important to remember that the priorities for men's and women's soccer are not always necessarily the same. The W-League probably does need more teams, but what it needs more urgently is a longer season and better wages and conditions for the players. It is positive, however, to see that the most expansion bids have included the W-League in their thinking. Let me finish by saying this. Australian soccer has experienced profound changes since 1977. The journey from a traditional community-owned enterprise to a private commercial enterprise has at times been painful and uncomfortable, but it has also been a necessary process for the game to survive on a national basis. As the debate between the expansionists and the traditionalists continues, it's important to remember that soccer in this country desperately needs consistency and stability. Stability will foster the development of large, vibrant, and representative supporter cultures. Stability will encourage investment from the clubs, from sponsors, and from broadcast partners. Stability will help Australians build professional careers in the A-League and the W-League. And most of all, stability will turn our focus away from the boardroom and the balance sheet and back to the field of play. Thanks very much for listening.